trauma is one of those 21st century buzzwords that seems to have grown in popularity and understanding over the last 20 to 30 years. When I was a kid, I think my personal understanding of the word was almost exclusively in the context of post-traumatic stress disorder and medical trauma, like from a car accident. And even then, I understood PTSD to be something that only soldiers suffered from. I was under the impression that in order to qualify as being a person who has suffered from or is still living with some form of trauma, you have to have gone through something as objectively horrific as an active war zone. I don't think I knew then how incredibly common a thing trauma actually is, and how many different forms it takes. Thinking of it now, it seems obvious. Trauma is simply the result of a painful event that left a long-lasting mark like a bruise or a scar. In other words, it's the psychological or physical result of a disruptive or disturbing moment in the course of a person's life. The older you get and the more people you meet, the more stories you hear, you start to realize that trauma is more than likely something that everyone alive at some point or other, and in some form or other, has dealt with. And I think understanding that basic truth is a major key in the development of a healthy sense of compassion and empathy. My guest today has made it her life's work to help people understand and heal from their trauma. She's even written a book on the topic that you should definitely check out. It's called Trauma Intelligence: The Art of Helping in a World Filled with Pain. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to Blythe Landry about trauma. Really excited to have you here, and I'm excited we finally found some time to do this. I know we've been talking about doing it for a while, and I'm glad that it gets to line up with the release of your book. That's so exciting and cool, and I can't wait to get it and thumb through it and learn all about how I can heal from my trauma and unpack that whole tangled mess. Let's begin a little bit, just like giving the audience a little bit of a rundown of like your personal, experience with this stuff and like journey, your work, your background in this area, in this field. Give a qualification, if you will. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll give the human qualification and I'll give the professional qualification.
All right. Excellent. Yes. So, I love that.
You know, even from the human qualification is that, even from a very young age, I've always been sort of drawn to those like dark spaces with people, right? Mm-hmm. And one could argue that that was maybe a trauma response from childhood, but the reality of it is I've always been willing to go, even at a young age, to dark or emotional spaces with people that maybe a lot of other people weren't comfortable going towards.
I relate similar to that.
Say that again?
I just said I relate.
Oh, that I can see that about you. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And, you know, it's similar, I think, with people who are drawn to being there for others with physical duress. That's mm-hmm. not my thing. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's always been there. I've always been curious about human emotions. I remember as a young child, you know, seeing an older man who may very well have been thrilled to be eating at a restaurant alone. Right. But I wept to my mother saying, you know, what if he's lonely? What if he needs a friend? So that's where that was always coming from. So, you know, even in high school, up through college, up through now I'm going to be 47 in a few weeks, there's always been some semblance of either volunteering or engaging in worlds of people who may be needing support for different reasons.
Sure.
So that's the emotional. The professional qualification is that, you know, I started getting educated at a pretty young age in terms of education in terms of academics, as well as education in terms of emotions. So I'm from New Orleans. I moved to Chicago when I was 22, and I worked for a program called Inner City Teaching Corps, where I was able to get a master's in education through that program. And mm-hmm. then I also went I got a master's in social work. I'm one of those overeducated people. And then I actually have done a lot of training in between. I'm a certified grief recovery method specialist. I'm a certified death midwife. And all that's to say, those are sort of the academic qualifications, plus 20 years of experience I've had in working directly with those coping with trauma, grief, and addictions. So after those educational endeavors, I sort of really fell into working with people one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And over the last decade or so, it's really evolved into international coaching and also working with companies. So I recently did a training on trauma intelligence with a Fortune 100 company, and I've worked with several nonprofits, and more are coming in down the line. And so I'm now building that business as well as helping people one-on-one, and then of course now the book. So that's sort of what I do professionally.
All right, I like it. I feel that's a good qualification. Those are good. That's a good resume. Yeah. I like it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Working with people doing this, you talked a little bit about being drawn toward the emotional side of it, people who are struggling with emotional trauma, emotional pain, emotional issues, versus people who are drawn to helping people with maybe more physical issues, and just that you might be drawn more toward one than the other. I think people ask ER doctors and nurses this question all the time, where it's just sort of like, does that take a toll seeing person after person after person coming in with a broken arm or a spiral fracture in their tibia or a bike handlebar shoved through their abdomen or like whatever? Does the gore of it all, does the physical trauma of it all, or do you flip a switch and you're in work mode and like you're just in the mode of figuring out the puzzle, figuring out what the treatment plan needs to be? And I guess I would apply that same question to your line of work is like, do you, in working with all these people, do you find that it, because this is my concern always whenever I'm like working with a therapist or a social worker or anything like that is like, I know this person does this for a living. I know that I'm not the only person that they're seeing. I know that they've been doing it for years. I mean, sometimes you're working with someone who's newer, but there's always part of me that's like, how much am I like burdening them with my bullshit and my trauma and my issues? And or do they ever hear people like me and just go like, oh Jesus Christ, dude, you have no idea how easy you've got it. Like I have so many people that I'm working with who actually need help and you just need to like grow the fuck up. But I don't know, like what's your experience? Is there a part of you that gets affected by that, or are you able to like switch into work mode and be like, no, it's work, it's just another day at the office?
Sure. I think there's a multifaceted answer to that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the first part of it is, I mean, I'm a human being with emotions, right? So especially early in my career, it was something that I had to learn to work with. It's kind of like learning to work with any emotion. It's a new emotion when you start hearing things that maybe either you have experienced or things you couldn't have imagined another person to experience, right? And so the sort of job sort of negative byproduct of that is that you begin to see things in the world potentially in a way that's a little bit less rose-colored glasses, so to speak. Okay, so with that, however, there is a process that I've personally gone through. I can't speak for everyone else, but as I've evolved in my work and my own recovery from my own challenges, right? What I've come to really work with and realize in this piece of working with others is that even if I had a similar experience, what their experience absolutely did not happen to me. Mm. And so if I begin to take it on too much, I'm shifting the energy from them needing support from me to me almost taking something from them and feeling that for them. And so for me, I've really found great success in doing this long term by really working with that. Maybe it's a spiritual idea, maybe it's a humanist idea, but that, wait a minute, I don't get to have too many feelings about this because I'm not the one that's endured this in this exact way, in this moment, in this time. Mm. And so that's really helped me. And maybe that's how I've empowered myself. Maybe I've dissociated, who knows, but it works for me. And then the other piece of it is You have to figure out which population you can work with. You know, I have worked with different populations, and some of them, it would be crying myself every night to sleep because I just couldn't manage how sad. Now, that kind of detracts from what I just said. But when I found the right population, what I found with people with severe trauma and severe grief, you know, losing a child in a car accident, things like murder, all these things, is that they get better.
Yeah.
So I love the redemption story, right? Right. That's part of my interest in the darkness, is there's always a light if you can work with it. And so I get the good grace of having the opportunity to see that people actually heal and get better. So yeah. That's the plus side. I think the biggest byproduct of doing this kind of work, especially when you hear things that you just, there's a few times in my career, you've heard something, you're just like, no, that, no, I don't want that exists, right? But at the same time, you know, you have to be able to do personal work and really get to this place where it's like, oh, that exists, but let me go find some other things that exist that are really positive, that are making sure. a difference. So, I mean, it's sort of that light and darkness in life. So that's what's worked for me.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that, but it's almost like you're utilizing tools that you've learned through your academic pursuits and through just your experience in the field. You have to utilize tools to keep a healthy emotional distance
Exactly.
keep yourself in a space where you can be this vessel or person to hear these experiences, but not get personally involved with it. It's like a friend of mine, his fiance is a doctor, and he was telling me recently that, like, it's so funny because she'll get kind of grossed out by things like picking up the dog's poo on a walk. Like, she'll be like, ugh, I don't want to pick up, like, the dog poo. But, like, at work, she has to do way grosser stuff all the time. But it's like there's something about the headspace of work where it's just like, well, this is different. I'm almost a different person here, where I'm like, my role is to facilitate helping people through pain and awkwardness. And, you know, if I'm helping someone deliver a baby and they shit the bed, that's just part of it. Like, that's just part of that process. You know what I mean?
I would agree with you wholeheartedly there. I mean, that's why I say I'm not sure if it's, you know, skill or dissociation or just functioning optimally so that you can survive in a situation, but it works for me, you know? And I think too, if we have sort of a purpose that feels fulfilling, we do learn to sort of put things aside in that moment so that we can continue to fulfill that, you
yeah.
know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Let's talk while we're getting started and kicking things off. Let's talk a little bit about your book that that is out. Like, what motivated you to want to write the book, and what do you think is kind of like one of the central things that you're trying to get at in the book, or that you feel like the book offers that maybe you haven't heard elsewhere, or that, like, are you bringing a unique perspective to this, or is there a like kind of a central theme that you're trying to, like, drive out with this thing?
Absolutely. So I'll start with the motivation for it, and then I'll answer the second part of the question. Mm-hmm. So I've always been a writer. I've always enjoyed, like, sharing narratives. And I, you know, have written for several publications, et cetera, et cetera. And people have always said, oh, you should write something, you should write a book, but there was never an inspiration there for me, right? And August of 2020, my oldest sister, who was 62, unexpectedly died.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, she was a great big sister for many years, and she suffered with her own addictions that were very plaguing. And she was also equally a wonderful person. I mean, these things are complicated, right?
Yeah, of course.
And she woke up one morning, she had been ill, and she had a stroke. I mean, a seizure and a heart attack at the same time. And she went hypoxic, and she never came to again. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to her on a Monday, and I didn't talk to her regularly at this point in our lives for several reasons. But, you know, my mom urged me to call her the day before she died. And for some reason I did. And I'm so grateful for that urging, because that was the last time I ever spoke to her. Mm. And so a friend of mine said, you should just start writing. Like, she's always seen that I should write this book, so she suggested I start writing. And that's how it began. And it was also happening during the pandemic, and there was such a surge in business and a surge in trauma and a surge of discussion around it, right? And then I started writing the book, and I would write a lot at once and a little at sometimes. And then one of my best friends had been diagnosed with cancer. She, in a different way, had been sick for years, and in May of this year, she was 52 and she passed away. And the book ended with her passing away. And the thing that's really amazing about that is her dream in life was to be a writer, and she didn't launch that in the way that she could have had she had more time. And so that was, for me, a spiritual bookend of great loss for me, but also a bookend on, wait a minute, why am I waiting for things? We're not promised anything, right? And so they have kind of, in those losses, supported me in getting this project going. So in terms of the book, it's very practical, Austin. So the thing that I, know about myself is that I have all the skills and the training and the education and the years of experience. The thing that doesn't matter to me as much as that is that I am helpful. So the book is really intended to be very practical. It's intended to be for any audience, okay? It's not an intellectual exercise or an academic book. It is an emotional exercise. So I'll tell you the exact layout of it. It covers what I think are five major categories of trauma. It explains what trauma is. It tells you what those are. I cover in the five major categories, I talk about childhood trauma, ambiguous trauma, which is something a lot of people experience in very serious ways that we don't talk about. I talk about catastrophic trauma, communal trauma, and workplace trauma. And then I talk about five other categories of trauma towards the end of the book. So then for every type of trauma, there's a chapter with narratives, relatable narratives, showing you this is how this type of trauma shows up in some people's lives. And then following that is a chapter which I think is very useful and very unique in that there's a chapter following each type of trauma that says these are three major ways this type of trauma shows up in people's lives in behavioral manifestations in the workplace, at home, in relationships, in friendships, in communities. And these are recommended accommodations you can make for people that you care about, even though you're not professional. And these are things you can apply in your everyday life. And then there's questions and answers and journaling exercises and all the things, right? So the purpose of this is really for someone to pick this up and go, wait, I can do this, right? It doesn't have to be. I think most of the people making a difference in the world are not people doing what you're doing or I'm doing. Most of the people making a difference are like working at the local gas station, people that are working in schools that are not necessarily in positions of power, people who are living next to a child and seeing they're struggling at home and inviting them over for cookies or a snack. They're people who need tools that are already making a difference that may not necessarily have those skills or those tools just from lack of exposure.
That sounds like a really interesting and good outline. The thing that really stood out to me, so I feel like when you list those five types of trauma, it was childhood, ambiguous, communal, workplace, and what was the other one?
Catastrophic, like, the shooting in Vegas or think September 11th, which was both catastrophic and communal, right?
Or if you had an entire family dies in a car crash and it's like and you're like the survivor and you're like th this is a catastrophe. This is a a catastrophic event. I feel like I can ostensibly picture every one of those five. The one that I'm like, what is that? That makes me go, tell me more about that is ambiguous. I want to know more about this.
And it's the one where there's so much silent suffering. Okay. There's ambiguous grief, there's ambiguous trauma. Okay. I'm going to give you a long, quick spout off of all the different things. Let's say you get a traumatic brain injury, right? And you're married and you one person and then you're another person and your spouse is like, well, I'm staying, but I'm married to a stranger and that's like never going to change. And everyone gets bored of listening to me and they go away. So then I'm all alone and I'm adult. I've got 40 potentially more years of this. And what do? I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm afraid. I'm alone. And it's a trauma that continues to reverberate. Or let's take your catastrophic trauma. Then let's say someone dies in a car crash, and then as a result of that trauma, we can have ambiguous trauma where then grandma and grandpa, one of them was sober, they're not sober anymore because they lost people in a car crash or a plane
Sure.
crash, right?
Yeah.
Then that reverberates into another child in the family. An adult child then goes, I don't have my parents anymore, so I've lost them as a result. It's things like cancer, which can also be under medical trauma, which is at the end of the book, but that's things like addiction in a family causes serious ambiguous trauma. Okay. Both
Yeah.
in ourselves and in the people we love. It's like watching a wildfire that if you run into it, you're going to burn to death, but you don't want to look away. Right. So it's those things. It's long-term fear of loss of job or anxiety around work. So not just acute workplace trauma. It's
How
all
about like ideological differences amongst family members or something? Like people like having like an ideological disagreement about politics or religion or something like that. And it's this thing that, 'cause that's like what I'm hearing here is like, oh, so you can have these things where, 'cause I've had family members come and be like, honestly, this disagreement that we've had has caused pain for years now, you know? And going through processes where like that stuff comes up where it's like, oh wow, you know? And that is that kind of the crux of what ambiguous trauma could be?
it can be. It
Yeah.
depends on the feeling involved, right? So, and what's painful for someone that's having a political differentiation in their family may not be painful for someone else because their whole family is homeless and on drugs, you know? So it's
Yeah.
like, it's relative,
Sure.
right? But it's anything that is ongoing, that is not fixable through conversation or medical treatment or action that continues to go on and on. Of course, like one of the examples in the book is incarceration, right?
Yeah.
I'm home, someone I love is incarcerated. That's ambiguous. I don't know if they're getting out, if they're not getting out, if they are getting out, if they're going to get sober, if they're, you know, what's going to happen. That could end. The person could eventually get out. But then you've got the ambiguous trauma of lost time. So
Okay.
yeah, it can be things like Alzheimer's, like, you know, you're family is there, but they're not there. It's something that most people don't talk about, and it's actually one of the most common things going on, and it makes people feel really, really alone because the thing that is most common, especially with ongoing pain, is that almost everyone will eventually go back and disappear and not be there for you anymore.
Yeah, this one I think the reason why that this category stood out to me as you were listing the different categories is that the other ones feel like something that I can name in a more acute way. That if it's childhood trauma, if it's I was heavily physically abused as a child, and I'm just saying this as an example. I'm not talking about myself right now, but if I but you know that's something that I can point at and go, this happened when I was a kid, and it's this. Maybe it's an event that has a specific date, a place, a person attached to it, and it's like a and same with catastrophic trauma, same with communal trauma, like 9/11, like we're all witnessing this thing together. It's very acute. It's very pronounced. I'm fascinated by this idea of the fact that there's all these almost like microaggressive traumas that are playing out that we're not noticing because they're not the big events. They're not the big pointed acute event, but it's this ongoing thing that has been an issue for years that doesn't that just sort of nags. And it could be something as simple as just like I seem to have a hard time getting over a certain hump in my relationships. Like there's a point at which I can't seem to get past with people. And that, you know, and then that causes this like anxiety spiral of like I don't know. That's really interesting.
That is very painful. Recurring patterns as an ambiguous trauma, right?
Right.
And not, like you said a little bit ago, they're not always things you can name. And they're not necessarily, I mean, sure, if, you know, if I'm married and my spouse gets a traumatic brain injury, people are going to show compassion for that. But again, over time, it dissipates. But with things like I keep getting stuck in relationships, and this, people tend to get sick of hearing about it, right?
Yeah.
And so then you feel isolated. Then you really can't get past this. Phases in relationships because nobody's sticking around to work through it. And so that's also like all these other traumas can lead to ongoing ambiguous trauma depending on the response. And then depending on your childhood is how we respond to all the other things. Right. So if you grow up with like a seemingly healthy sort of sense of self and a secure attachment style and all this stuff, those other things might be, of course, if your whole family is, you know, dies in a car crash, you're going to be devastated.
Yeah.
But if you have childhood trauma and that, then the things you think about it may also induce further trauma that, you know, wasn't related to the actual death, but you might be blaming yourself, or you might feel like you're not lovable, or all things that are added on to loss that come from history as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
As I've been looking into this, and not even just for this conversation, but it's just something I've been thinking about a lot lately in my life and over the last few years. And I have friends who are getting masters in social work right now, and we talk about it a lot and things like that. I've heard from some people, and I've definitely heard different schools of thought of this, but a few people that there's sort of this idea out there, and maybe it's, I don't know if it's a new idea or if it's a newer idea, but that like almost everything, almost every mental malady or spiritual malady or mental illness could be traced back to some form of trauma. Do you ascribe to that belief, or do you feel like trauma accounts for a lot of it, but not all of it? That other things could be as simple as a chemical imbalance, and that's not necessarily trauma based. It could be just genetic. Like, what are your feelings on that?
I think that if that's true or not is not as important as how we respond to people's pain. But what I will say is this. It's impossible for us to really know that, right? We'd have to get every human being in the entire world together to really know if that's true. Mm-hmm. I think it's an and or, maybe both, probably. I mean, I think lots of people like to sit and, you know, say, yes, this is definitely the thing. But if I knew it was definitely the thing, I'd have a lot more power than I really have. I think that a lot of hurt and responses to pain in life come from wounds. But we have to also remember that pain is relative. Wounds are relative. I mean, we're all born with a different level of like ability to sustain things. I might have experienced things like we were talking about before, and you were saying with therapies, like some of the things I've experienced, some people would be like a joke. They're not as painful to them, mm-hmm. right? But for me, they may have had long-term, very severe emotional, relational consequences. And there's other people who have had crazy things happen to them that are actually pretty emotionally stable.
Yeah.
And they don't end up as addicts. I mean, we already know that mental illness and addiction, they're also genetic in nature. But then we could also argue that, yeah, there's the chemical imbalance, but also what's the epigenetic, you know, generational trauma that has brought us to these behaviors? I mean, so I think it's, right? I mean, who knows? We think we know. So I do think, I always notice there's one person in every like generational line. I've noticed this, and I'm sure a lot of people have noticed this, but there's always one in every family that's really trying to heal.
Yeah.
You know? If you look around and you look at yourself and you think it's like, and maybe others will be inspired by that, but there's really one really fighting for it, fighting for that survival. And that makes me think, is there a spiritual component to this? Like, why me and not somebody else? Why you and not somebody else, you know?
Oh, I've definitely thought about that. When I think about going through the recovery process, and I talk about sort of like what the circumstances were that led me to need to get sober and stuff like that, I always talk about, because I'll meet people who are in the same condition, who are in the thick of it, who are currently sick, and I'm just sort of like, yeah, whether or not you're able to like latch on to a solution and really work it so that you can see whether or not it works, I don't know why I was able to. I don't know why. I have no idea why I was able to give a shit, because I've seen people die from the same condition, and I don't know what the difference is. I'm like, I don't know why that person wasn't able to latch on to a solution. They had the same opportunities that I did, went to the same meetings, like met the same people. I went with them, like they were there sitting right next to me. And so I'm like, I don't know why I was able to take the medicine and they weren't. I don't, you know, so that's an interesting question about is there some other element going on where there's some kind of spiritual or genetic predisposition to be able to
Well, because if you're looking at things like sobriety, I think the statistics are extremely jarring. Like, Almost no one tries to get sober. And I think of the people who actually make a full faith effort, the amount of sobriety after 2 years is almost non-existent. So why me? I mean, I don't want to say that I'm better because I'm not. I know my sister was amazing. She never got sober, you know? So why? I don't know. Maybe it's luck, maybe it's divinity, maybe I don't get to know, you know?
It's so hard to even pontificate because you're like, you definitely don't want it to be like, I guess I'm better. I guess I'm. Yeah,
I
I think that when you say that, when you're like, each family has one person that's really invested in healing, it's like, it sounds like, oh, so what, the other one, everyone else just doesn't give a shit? And it's like, no, it's like,
They tried. They really, really tried. And then that's where we go back to your question of was the trauma too painful? Was the reaction to the trauma too painful? Was it just bad luck? Was it divine intervention? Was it their time? Was it just not a fair life? Was it a crummy, shitty deal they got? You know, I don't know the
So,
answer to
in
that.
your professional experience in working with people, I mean, you talked about how you've seen people get better. I imagine in 20 years of experience, you've also seen people not
Oh,
recover.
yeah. I mean,
And
and I think, you know what I can always tell? If someone can keep coming past the discomfort, high likelihood. I have a really high success rate if people keep coming,
So that's
right?
what I was going to ask. I was going to say, what have you noticed are maybe behaviors or attributes contributing to a person's ability to have success with this, or something that you maybe see and go, I don't know if that person's going to make it. And is it as simple as that, just that they keep coming through the discomfort? Are there other things that you've noticed or observed over the years?
Willingness to be temporarily a little more miserable. I think that's always an indicator. I see it in recovery. I see it with clients. I've seen it with myself. You know, I think if someone comes and they're like, this is the most amazing thing ever, and I feel great already, that's a bad sign. One, because nobody's perfect. I'm going to disappoint them as a human being at some point. So we're already off to a shaky start. But also, the reality, well, it's true. I always tell people, like, I'm gonna mess up. I'm a person. So if you're idealizing me, we gotta nip that in the bud right now. But the other piece of it is like willingness to get a different kind of pain temporarily. Because most of the pain, like, that are reactions to trauma are really an avoidance of the actual hurt, the brokenheartedness, the disappointment in God, whatever that is, ourselves, our families. The real hurt is what needs to be touched and dealt with, right? So that's one indicator. Another indicator is willingness to take a risk, willingness to do things that seem stupid that actually do make a difference. And I think a willingness to be seen on some level and to try, because a lot of the people that come to me, maybe they've never had anyone safe, right? Just to go on hope that maybe there's one person, and then if I exist and I can do my best to be as humane and loving as possible, then maybe there's somebody else too. That's my goal with people, you know, to get them to believe that maybe somebody else could do that too in real life, you know, not just professionally.
Well, and again,
But those
to exhaust the metaphor of just comparing physical medicine to like emotional medicine, or a lot of times, if you have an issue that needs to be taken care of, like you and I were just talking about a tooth or something like that, then like the willingness to go, all right, well, it's probably not going to feel great, but I need to get this tooth yanked out, and it's probably going to be a whole other kind of pain.
That's right.
It's going to be some financial pain. It's going to be some like it's going to be a different kind of pain. It's going to be a week or two of like maybe some recovery pain, maybe like, but it that willingness to go, I'm willing to, because doing it is anxiety inducing.
Yes.
I was just seeing a therapist earlier this year on, we were doing video chats and like over Zoom, and it wasn't working out for me, and it had nothing to do with I don't think this person was messing up or anything. But one thing that I kept saying, and I kept telling this to friends and my sponsor and stuff, is I was like, I'm not uncomfortable in there, and this person is not really trying to like push any buttons. They sort of just like, we sort of just have chats, and it's just sort of like a 50-minute long chat. And I'm like, I kind of want someone who's gonna like make me cry, and like who's gonna like,
I want a safe space to like feel through some stuff and to get uncomfortable and to maybe like push on some buttons that like haven't been pushed on in a little bit, even though that scares me. And even the thought of that, even acknowledging that like that's what I think I need if this is going to be successful, is like someone who's maybe going to like push on some tender spots and like maybe like poke some emotional, like some pent up, like maybe some emotional baggage that I'm hanging on to somewhere that I can't see, and like poke at it and see if we can get it to shake loose or something. That scares me, but I think, well, God, if I'm going to get my money's worth, I probably need that. You know?
But that's a good sign about you, because it means that you, like, we just kind of what we were talking about, going back to that family thing and one person, it's like you want your soul, whatever you want to call it, your being, your humanness, has a desire to expand, right? So there's some part of you that knows that, like, if you're not uncomfortable, nothing's changing. And I think a lot of professionals are afraid to challenge people. Maybe because of their own trauma, maybe because, who knows? But I think it's, if you're going to help someone, you have to do it. The thing about a professional doing that is they're taking a risk too, right? They have to be willing to take a risk to not be liked, to be, you know, a little bit, you know, different in that sense. And I think, it says volumes about your desire to grow, that you want to be miserable for a short time, Austin, so that you can feel better. But if you really think about it, different is better. So again, I want to make sure to hone in that point. Trauma is trauma. The reaction to trauma is usually a pattern of behavior that ends up hurting us more. That's either deflective or protective. And then the healing is, am I going to let anyone, someone, maybe a professional therapist, maybe a coach, maybe a spiritual guru, maybe a yoga, I don't know, whatever works for each person, but am I going to let someone get a little, maybe a friend, but am I going to let someone get close enough to me so that I can have some kind of tender reaction inside myself that hurts, but is also like, wait, this hurts in a way that doesn't feel the same. So, because, yeah.
It is, man, as a person with severe anxiety, I can catastrophize about all kinds of things. I can really dream up some like really gnarly scenarios and really give myself great excuses not to do this stuff. And like where my brain goes is that I'm like, yeah, but what if something gets shaken loose that no one in the room is ready to deal with? Like what if I'm hanging on to something that they like shake loose and I have a full psychotic break because of it? And it's just kind of like, oh, that was the linchpin that was keeping my sanity together. And we pulled that thing out because we were just toying around and we were being reckless in there. And now I have no idea who I am or what year it is. And I'm like drooling in a institution somewhere with a bathrobe and slippers. Like that's literally my brain goes there. I'm like, what if I'm permanently broken from this? So I'm like, it's kind of this like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it thing where I'm like, it's fine. It's all holding together well enough. And it makes me think of my teeth where I'm like, for the most part, I was like, I'm not feeling too much pain. Until things are so bad that I can't stand it, I think I can like make this work. I can ride this broken tricycle down the street a little further. But you know what I mean? Like that's the fear. Have you ever experienced something like that where you're like poking around with someone and whoops, something comes slipping free from the buried recesses of the subconscious, and all of a sudden that person is like off the deep end broken? Or is that a fantasy that my anxiety is telling me?
So far in my experience, it's your greatest fantasy that your anxiety is producing, but I can't say that that's never happened in any room anywhere, right? So sure. I don't want to minimize your fear. Yeah. However, I would say more likely is something will come out and you might temporarily go back to familiar behaviors, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. Because those familiar behaviors are safe pain. It's crazy what we'll do to avoid those very fears. And you and I both know, as people who can just intellectually talk about this, that the thing we're most afraid of is never going to be the thing that slays us. So it's going to be this, that old saying, you're always one call away from a totally different life. It's like the thing you think is the thing, and it's so extravagant, right? And then the little thing comes and just knocks you down because you can't plan for the damn thing. So, but My hope for you and my belief for you, Austin, is that that's not going to be the thing that happens to you.
Yeah, I'm never right about this stuff in my experience.
No, that's what anxiety is. I can relate to that on a very profound level. The level of creation that I have in my mind, I should be a fiction writer. I mean, that we could write a book, and it would be really interesting.
I'm just going to write a book that everyone's going to be like, have you read this book? You can't make it through it without having 4 panic attacks yourself. My goal is just going to be to stress out the reader and be like, and it's just going to be called Worst Case Scenario, the book. And then it's just going to be me just saying, here's everything that could go wrong on your trip to Disneyland. And I'm just going to list it all off. Here's everything that could go wrong when you go ask for that raise at work. And I'm you know, and maybe there'll be some kind of healing on the other side of that where we'll go, cool. So that's all the things. And since those are all pretty far-fetched, go do it. Go do the thing, you know.
Maybe a bestseller. You never know.
Here's a question. You talked a little bit earlier about, and this is something I'm aware of too, like, and I don't think that a lot of people really know this, that A, most people don't ever actually try to get sober. It's not an insanely rare thing to do. There are millions of people who do it every year or who attempt to do it worldwide, but it's also not like the most common thing. I think more often than not, people that you meet are people who use some kind of substance either daily or regularly to cope with just existence and life. And that's fine. And then in that number of people who do attempt sobriety, there is a very small success rate. And a lot of my friends who are doing social work or who are in therapy will bring this up to me, will be like, man, the success rates are so low with that stuff, with 12-step programs and with things like that. Like it's, and they, you know, I kind of always hate hearing about the odds, because I'm just like, I can't think about that. I can't think about the fact that like,
I think your worst case scenario will really kick in.
Yeah. Cause I'm like, trust me, it doesn't make sense to me either. Like I don't buy that I'm going to stay sober for the rest of my life. I can buy that I can make it to the end of the day, and that's about it. But I still am like, I don't buy it that I'm going to make it to the end. But we'll see. But what I want to ask is, psychedelic therapy. There's been all these studies and things that have shown that not only is psychedelic therapy really effective at working through trauma and doing that thing that we kind of talked about of like taking your brain into sort of a neuroplasticity state where you can sort of go through these old storylines or work through these old traumatic events and try to give them a new context and recontextualize them and bring them back into that sober state out of the psychedelic experience. And that people are having experience or success with that with trauma and with addiction. What are your thoughts on that? What do you feel about psychedelic therapy? Do you think it's a crock of shit, or do you find it interesting? Or?
Okay, it's not something I'm an expert on, so I'll just share that. So here's my thought. It probably helps somebody somewhere, and if the science says it does, then certainly it does. However, my other thought, and maybe this is my vicarious traumatization from listening to trauma for all this time that we were talking about earlier, it's a huge moneymaker too. So, sure. Right now, it's the it thing. There's always an it thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm always dubious about it things, especially for me personally as a sober person. I wouldn't do it because like we were talking about before we started recording, my brain might say, well, that might be really interesting to do every weekend. Because it's like so fun to spend as much money as possible to do as many things as possible. However, I would never outright say no, it wouldn't help someone. I do know someone who told me that they had a completely life-changing experience as a result. That person does not happen to be an addict, though. They had a recreation of a trauma that really transformed their life and their perspective. The other thing I'm doubtful about with this kind of stuff is, and maybe this is because I'm just a long hauler in life, I've always been a person who keeps the same therapist for many years, who has friends for my whole life, who does I always think of things as a long haul.
Sure.
I'm always also doubtful about things that purport to be a quick fix because so I go do that or I go to rehab, and obviously some rehabs are really helpful. What happens next? What happens next? Am I just transformed? Things like EMDR, they do transform people in some ways. but they don't transform all the behavioral manifestations of something that then later show up. I mean, I don't know that you could go and do this once and then every situation in your life that that was impacting just suddenly goes away. And what are your thoughts on it?
Well, so I tend to feel the same way that you do. And when it's been pitched to me, my response has been like, that's great, and I am not, I don't deny it, or I don't think like, ah, what I think that that's wonderful. And I having had lots of experience doing psychedelic drugs recreationally, I can certainly be like, I can see how that could be used in a clinical setting. I really can. I could see how, and I understand what people are talking about when they talk about neuroplasticity and the ability to kind of go in almost with a fresh slate and be like, oh, I understand something differently than I did before. I've come out of experiences tripping on acid before and been like, I just know something about this thing that I didn't used to know. Or I like under, you know, I somehow, some way that was able to become clear in that state. And I could see how doing that with a trained professional who walks you through it and who has like a treatment plan for that session, how it could be transformational and really, really useful. My response has always been, I'm not going to do it just because I have medicine that currently is working and I'm not trying to mess with that. Like I my sobriety is too precious of a thing for me to kind of like gamble with. If I felt like my methodology or medicine was ceasing to work for me, and if I maybe had a big relapse, and say I tried to go back to my current methodology and I just couldn't get the same results from trying it again, maybe then I'd look into it. You know, but I definitely think that different treatment plans for different folks. I get people who ask me all the time if they think that my way of getting sober is the only way of doing it, and I'm always like, no, I don't think that. It's the thing that worked for me. It's the thing that I feel like I tried a lot of different things, and it's the thing that sort of was transformational for me. But I do think that there are different pathways there. And I'm also skeptical, like you, of anything that purports to be kind of an overnight or quick fix, because I can imagine how you could have an experience with something, with MDMA, with ketamine, with psilocybin, and I can imagine how you could have an experience that could have you riding high for weeks, months, you know, and that you could be like, wow, that was really, really tr I feel free. I feel lighter. I still feel like my personal experience with this stuff is that it has a way of lingering and hanging out and being patient and waiting and coming back in new, unsuspected ways, which I think brings me to my next concern, which is like, is that just the nature of this stuff of trauma? Like, can trauma be fixed permanently, or is it only something that can be worked on for a lifetime? Because there are other things that you can like you can have a, you know, you can have a form of cancer and like be cancer free 5 years later, and they can be like, no, we got it, like it's taken care of, and you can go the rest of your life without getting cancer again. And I don't know, like, do you think that it's possible to find a long-term solution where someone goes, I'm done. I don't need to put money and time into that treatment plan anymore. I can move on and work on other things. Or is the only long-term solution to trauma a lifelong treatment plan?
I think that it's absolutely possible to move beyond these things. And I think the way that I look at it, and this is another metaphor to, you know, if I'm a triathlete and I'm a really good damn triathlete, you know, I'm like Iron Man, I'm doing all the stuff, I'm no body fat, it's all the things, and I get in a car accident and I'm paraplegic, I can still become an athlete again, right? In different ways. I might be the best para athlete that exists, right? Like I might be number one because I'm just, that's my personality. I'm always going to know somewhere in my mind that it's not the same experience as I had before, right? So I think of it like, you know, it doesn't mean I'm not happy. It doesn't mean I can't live a fulfilling life. It doesn't mean I'm not amazing. It doesn't mean I'm not the best damn athlete out there. It means that it's a different experience. So I think of it like 80-20. You know, like if you have something horrific, like long-term, systemic, ongoing childhood sexual abuse, torture, I mean, are you ever going to get to a place where that never comes across your mind? I find that impossible. But I do think you can get to a place with the right treatment, but also the right choices and people, not recurring choices of people that are going to abuse you more and more, which is a very hard thing to do if you've had trauma. You can get to a place where 80% of the time you're in a good place. You have a functional life, and that's the most any of us can hope for, regardless of our level of trauma, right? So I've seen people with things that I couldn't even imagine existed in this world. And I have my own, like, obviously I'm interested in this stuff because I have a lot of my own traumas and relational stuff and challenges. But I've heard things that I would not repeat. They're so horrifying to even put in your brain. And those people, I've seen those people have very fulfilling lives and relationships and choose healthy relationships and, be super okay. And then they have moments of not, but that's a life for you. So I think that some of the thing with healing is also to get a sense of self-trust back. That's what we lose with trauma. So if you're healing in a certain way, then it becomes like, I don't need this plan anymore because now I've gained trust in myself. And that's a real healing, or a faith that my intuition is going to be good. I don't need to get the opinions of every professional out there now because now I'm trusting my own self. That's a real healing. So I would hate to see anyone in treatment in the same intensity for their entire lives because then they've taken on that sick identity. And I think there has to be a willingness to heal from trauma in the sense that you're also willing to let go of, I'm a sick person, or I have all these problems, So yeah, I've seen people heal. But I do think it's one of those things, depending on the level of trauma, that you want to go 80-20, and you also want to think of it like, you don't want to pretend like it didn't happen. So that informs things about you that may be challenges for the people in your lives, but it also informs many of your amazing qualities as well.
Oh, geez, that's good stuff. That's really good. I like conversations like this with people in your field, especially on the podcast, because it's like I get therapy for free. So that's I like
That was
taking.
the whole point in this. It was totally all about you tonight,
Yeah, I
Austin.
like taking advantage of my platform with as a podcaster to be like, yes, come talk to me about this, and then I never have to pay an actual therapist. I just do one interview with a different therapist at a time, and
They're
I,
all about mental health.
yeah. And I'm always just like, and what would you do if a person was struggling with? And I just say something completely, and I'm like, oh, interesting. This is all just hypothetical. But hypothetically, let's say.
And if you ever do bring the therapy series back, I'd love to make a cameo. I love your therapy. Your therapist, it's freaking hilarious.
Well, I've got a backup account now on TikTok because everyone has to have a backup account because TikTok likes to ban people for just whatever
I
reason.
know.
It's just a very common thing over there. And I've been bringing, well, I've been reposting the therapist series, and it's always fun to sort of revive that character and have people who have never seen it before be like, "What is this?" And like, it is, I think it's one of my favorite characters that's come out of all of that stuff. So,
It's hilarious and wonderful and true. And yes, I do want to say that I'm hosting a book club on Clubhouse.
Ooh, okay.
Go to Blythe Coach. It starts November 4th. It's going to be conversations about the book, but also non-therapy related trauma discussions. I'm going to have special guests talking about different things they've experienced, different expertise. I think it's going to be fun.
Awesome. What's the book called, and where can people get it?
Okay, so it's called Trauma Intelligence: The Art of Helping in a World Filled with Pain. You can get it on Amazon. You can also get it on my website at blythelandry.com. You can get it on Barnes and Noble. I think you can get it on Thrift Books too, but you can get it if you want to use Amazon, it's there. If you're not an Amazon person, you can get it through my website. You can get it on Barnes and Noble. And you can also contact me directly and order through me as well, and I can get it directly from the printer.
So you got the Clubhouse thing going on where it's Blythe Coach on Clubhouse. Can people follow you on social media elsewhere?
Yes, Instagram is Blythe Landry Coach. Facebook is my page is totally public. I use it all for my stuff, my business stuff, and my trauma stuff, my grief stuff, my addiction stuff. And that's Blythe Landry. The funny part about that is there are two of us, and I'm the one in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The other one's on the East Coast. We are Facebook friends. So you can just follow me at Blythe Landry Albuquerque Facebook, Blythe Landry Coach, Blythe Landry Coach on Instagram, and Blythe Coach on Clubhouse.
Does the other Blythe Landry do what you do?
No, but she has my book. It's really sweet. She ordered my book. And,
oh, that's fun.
We're going to meet one day. We will.
I was going to say, because for a while, and I don't know what he's doing now, but for a while there was another Austin Archer who was in Georgia, and he was a singer-songwriter, and we were both releasing albums at the same time. And I was like, one of us has to cave here. I was like, because we can't both be putting
that's
out.
That's hilarious.
And because we were both unknown, Spotify and Apple Music kept putting our albums under the same thing, and we were like,
oh wow,
it's like, no, they're two different people. But he hasn't released an album since like 2014, so I think I won the battle of the Austin
totally
Archers
won.
But I don't,
yes,
I don't know what he's doing now. I should reach out to him.
So you should you know, you should see where he is and
make sure he's okay, you know. Yeah,
I know he may need some support, so yeah, we don't know. Well, is there anything else that, you know, you want to know about or hear about or get some professional help about while we've got
Can I just, how much can I milk this for while I'm getting it for free?
No, you know, I've been wanting to do this for a long time, so I'm really glad. And like, I'll tell the audience, you're one of my clients. One of my clients is one of your biggest fans. So.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I love that. That's awesome. No, this was great. This was fantastic. I'm really, really excited to get the book. I'm excited for you and the fact that the book is out. This was a really great chat, and this was a lot of fun. I thank you so much for making the time to do this.
Thank you too. It's been a blast.
All right, well, that was excellent. I really enjoyed talking with her. I'm glad that we were able to connect. I found that very informative, and I would have kept going if I could. You know, I start to feel when I'm having conversations like that, like I'm really just abusing that person's time that typically costs a lot of money. Obviously, she's willing to come here to promote her book, but I am like, I'm getting all these free, juicy tips, and now all of you get to get it too. You know, that's stuff that comes at a premium if you want to go to someone's office and get that same info, you know, some of that stuff. So that's good stuff. You know, I need to talk to more people in that field just so I can have free sessions of therapy. Go check out Blythe's book. Again, it is called Trauma Intelligence, The Art of Helping in a World Filled with Pain. Go check that out, and maybe buy a bunch of copies and give them to your friends and family for Christmas, which is coming up. That's a good idea. Do that. Cool. All right, that's the episode. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com or looking up Austin Archer on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you stream music. My music and this podcast are mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. Chrissy is the best in the business. Hit him up at themarmalademusic.com. Tell him Austin sent you, say you heard his work on Austin Archer's podcast, and if you tell him that you heard his work on People Pleaser, he's going to give you 20% off of your first project when you work with him on your thing. So go hit him up, tell him that I sent you, get 20% off your first project. It's a great deal. Patreon.com/AustinArcher is a way that you can support this show. We've already got people over there supporting this show. This show is brought to you by those people and by their very, very generous donations. So thank you to all of my Patreon patrons. You can join them and join the support for this show at patreon.com/AustinArcher. Okay, I think that's all the things. Thanks for being here. Thanks to Blythe again for the great episode. We'll see you next week. Love you so much. Bye-bye.